Random House Audio presents Victory of Eagles by Naomi Novik. Read for you by Simon Vance. Part 1. Chapter 1. The breeding grounds were called Penavan, after the hard, jagged slash of the mountain at their heart, like an axe blade, rimed with ice along its edge and rising barren over the moorlands. A cold, wet Welsh autumn already coming on towards winter, and the other dragons sleepy and remote, uninterested in anything but their meals. There were a few hundred of them scattered throughout the grounds, mostly established in caves or on rocky ledges, wherever they could fit themselves. Nothing of comfort or even order provided for them, except the feedings, and the mowed bare strip of dirt around the borders where torches were lit at night to mark the lines past which they might not go, with the town lights glimmering in the distance, cheerful and forbidden. Temeraire had hunted out and cleared a large cavern on his arrival to sleep in, but it would be damp no matter what he did in the way of lining it with grass or flapping his wings to move the air, which in any case did not suit his instinctive notions of dignity. Much better to endure every unpleasantness with stoic patience, although that was not very satisfying when no one would appreciate the effort. The other dragons certainly did not. He was quite sure he and Lawrence had done as they ought in taking the cure to France, and no one sensible could disagree. But just in case, Temeraire had steeled himself to meet with either disapproval or contempt, and he had worked out several very fine arguments in his defence. Most importantly, of course, it was just a cowardly, sneaking way of fighting. If the government wished to beat Napoleon, they ought to fight him directly, and not make his dragons sick to try and make him easy to defeat. As if British dragons could not beat French dragons without cheating. "And not only that," he added, "but it would not be only the French dragons who died. Our friends from Prussia who are imprisoned in their breeding grounds would also have got sick, and perhaps it might even have gone so far as China. And that would be like stealing someone else's food, even when you are not hungry, or breaking their eggs." He made this impressive speech to the wall of his cave, as practice. They had refused to give him his sand table, and he had no one of his crew to jot it down for him either. He did not have Lawrence, who would have helped him work out just what to say. So he repeated the arguments over to himself quietly instead, so he should not forget them. And if these should not suffice to persuade, he thought, he might point out that after all, he had brought the cure back in the first place. He and Lawrence, with Maximus and Lily and the rest of their formation, and if anyone had a right to say where it should be shared out, they did. No one would even have known of it if Temeraire had not contrived to be sick in Africa, where the mushrooms which cured it grew. He might have saved the trouble. No one accused him of anything, nor, as he had privately, a little wistfully thought just barely possible, hailed him as a hero, because they did not care. The older dragons, not feral but retired, were a little curious about the latest developments in the war, but only distantly. More inclined to tell over their own battles of earlier wars, and the rest had plenty of indignation over the recent epidemic, but only in a provincial way. They cared that they and their own fellows had sickened and died. They cared that the cure had taken so long to reach them, but it did not mean anything to them that dragons in France had also been ill, or that the disease would have spread, killing thousands if Temeraire and Lawrence had not taken over the cure. They also did not care that the Lords of the Admiralty had called it treason, and sentenced Lawrence to die. They had nothing to care for. They were fed, and there was enough for everyone. If the shelter was not pleasant, it was no worse than what even the retired dragons were used to from the days of their active service. They had none of them even heard of a pavilion, or thought they might be made more comfortable than they were. No one ever molested an egg. The groundskeepers would take them away, but with infinite care, in wagons lined with straw, hot water bottles and woolen blankets in the wintertime. And they would bring back reports until the eggs were hatched and no more of anyone's concern, so everyone knew the eggs were safe in their hands. Safer, even, than keeping them oneself. so even the dragons, who had not cared to take a captain themselves at all, would often as not hand over their own eggs. They could not go flying very far, because they were fed at no set time, but randomly, from day to day, so if one went away out of earshot of the bells, one was likely to come too late, and go hungry all the day. So there was no larger society, no intercourse with the other breeding grounds or with the coverts, except when some other dragon came from afar to mate. Even that was arranged for them. Instead they sat, willing prisoners in their own territory, Temeraire thought bitterly. He would never have endured it if not for Lawrence. Only for Lawrence, who would surely be put to death at once if Temeraire did not obey. He held himself aloof from their society at first. There was his cave to be arranged. Despite its fine prospect, it had been left vacant for being inconveniently shallow, and he was rather crammed in. But there was a much larger chamber beyond, visible through holes in the back wall, which he gradually opened up with the slow and cautious use of his roar. Slower, even, than perhaps necessary, he was very willing to have the task consume several days. The cave had then to be cleared of debris, old gnawed bones and inconvenient boulders which he scraped out painstakingly even from the corners too small for him to lie in, for neatness' sake. And he found a few rough boulders in the valley, and used them to grind the cave walls a little smoother by dragging them back and forth, throwing up a great cloud of dust. It made him sneeze, but he kept on. He was not going to live in a raw, untidy hole. He knocked down stalactites from the ceiling and beat protrusions flat into the floor, and when he was satisfied, he arranged along the sides of what was now his antechamber, with careful nudges of his talons, some attractive rocks and old dead tree branches, twisted and bleached white, which he had collected from the woods and ravines. He would have liked a pond and a fountain, but he could not see how to bring the water up or how to make it run when he had got it there, so he settled for picking out a promontory on Llyn y Fan Fawr, which jutted into the lake, and considering it also his own. To finish, he carved the characters of his name into the cliff face by the entrance, and also in English, although the letter R gave him some difficulty, and came out looking rather like the reversed numeral 4. Then he was done with that, and routine crept up and devoured his days. To rise when the sun came in at the cave mouth, to take a little exercise, to nap, to rise again when the herdsman rang the bell, to eat, then to nap and to exercise again, and then back to sleep, and that was the end of the day. There was nothing more. He hunted for himself once, and so did not go to the daily feeding. Later that day one of the small dragons brought up the groundsmaster, Mr. Lloyd, and a surgeon, to be sure that he was not ill, and they lectured him on poaching sternly enough to make him uneasy for Lawrence's sake. For all that, Lloyd did not think of him as a traitor either, did not think enough of him to consider him one. The groundsmaster only cared about his charges so far as they all stayed inside the borders and ate and mated. He recognised neither dignity nor stoicism, and anything which Temeraire did out of the ordinary was only a bit of fussing. "Come now, we have a fresh Lady Anglewing visiting today," Lloyd would say jocularly. "Quite a nice little piece. We will have a fine evening, eh? Perhaps we would like a bit of veal first? Yes, we would, I am sure," providing the responses with the questions, so Temeraire had nothing to do but sit and listen. And as Lloyd was a little hard of hearing, if Temeraire did try to say, "No, I would rather have some venison, and you might roast it first," he was sure to be ignored. It was almost enough to put one off making eggs, and in any case Temeraire was growing uncomfortably sure that his mother would not have approved in the least how often they wished him to try, and how indiscriminately. Lien would certainly have sniffed in the most insulting way. It was not the fault of the female dragons sent to visit him. They were all very pleasant, but most of them had never managed an egg before, and some had never even been in a real battle, or done anything interesting at all. So then they were embarrassed, as they did not have any suitable present for him which might have made up for it, and it was not as though he could pretend that he was not a very remarkable dragon, even if he liked to, which he did not very much, although he would have tried for Belusa, the poor young Malachite Reaper, without a single action to her name sent by the Admiralty from Edinburgh, who miserably offered him a small knotted rug, which was all her confused captain would afford. It might have made a blanket for Temeraire's largest talon.
"It is very handsome," Temeraire said awkwardly, "and so cleverly done. I admire the colours very much,"
and tried to drape it carefully over a small rock by the entrance, but the gesture only made her look more wretched, and she burst out.
"Oh, I do beg your pardon. He wouldn't understand in the least, and thought I meant I would not like to, and then he said—"
And she stopped abruptly, in even worse confusion, so Temeraire was sure that whatever her captain had said, it had not been at all nice. It was as painful as could be, and he had not even the satisfaction of delivering one of his cherished retorts, because it was not as though she herself had said anything rude, so he did not much want to. But he obliged anyway. He was determined he would be patient and quiet in all things. He would not cause any trouble. He would be perfectly good. Temeraire did not let himself think very much about Lawrence. He did not trust himself. It was hard to endure the perpetual sensation of deep unease, almost overpowering when he thought how he did not know how Lawrence was, what his condition might be. Temeraire was sure to know every movement where his breastplate was, and his small gold chain, these being in his own possession. His talon sheaths had been left with Emily, and he was quite certain she was to be trusted to keep them safe. Ordinarily, he would have trusted Lawrence, too, to keep himself safe. At least, if he were not proposing to do something dangerous for no very good reason, which he was sadly given to on occasion. But the circumstances were not what they ought to be, and it had been so very long. The Admiralty had promised that so long as he behaved, Lawrence would not be hanged. But they were not to be trusted. Not at all. Temeraire resolved, twice a week, that he should go to Dover at once, to London, only to make inquiries, to see they had not, only to be sure. But unwanted reason always asserted itself before he had even set out. He must not do anything which should persuade the government he was unmanageable, and therefore Lawrence of no use to them. He must be as complacent and accommodating as ever he might. It was a resolution already sorely tried by the end of his third week, when Lloyd brought him a visitor, admonishing the gentleman loudly.
"Remember now not to upset the dear creature, but to speak nice and slow and gentle, like a horse."
Infuriating enough, even before the gentleman was named to him as one Reverend Daniel Sulcombe.
"Oh, you," Temeraire said, which made that gentleman look aback. "Yes, I know perfectly well who you are. I have read your very stupid letter to the Royal Society, and I suppose you are come to see me behave like a parrot or a dog."
Sulcombe stammered excuses, but it was plainly the case. He began laboriously to read to Temeraire off a prepared list of questions, something quite nonsensical about predestination, but Temeraire would have none of it.
"Pray be quiet. St. Augustine explained it much better than you, and it still did not make any sense even then. Anyway, I'm not going to perform for you like a circus animal. I really cannot be bothered to speak to anyone so uneducated he has not read the Analects," he added, guiltily accepting Lawrence in the back of his mind. But then Lawrence did not set himself up as a scholar, and write insulting letters about people he did not know.
"And as for dragons not understanding mathematics, I am sure I know more of it than do you."
He scratched out with his claw a triangle in the dirt, and labelled the two shorter sides.
"There. Tell me the length of the third, and then you may talk. Otherwise, go away and stop pretending you know anything about dragons."
The simple diagram had perplexed several gentlemen when Temeraire had put it to them at a party in the London Covert, rather disillusioning Temeraire as to the general understanding of mathematics among men. The Reverend Sulcombe evidently had not paid much attention to that part of his education either, for he stared and coloured up to his mostly bare pate and turned to Lloyd furiously, saying,
"You have put the creature up to this, I suppose. You prepared the remarks."
The unlikelihood of this accusation striking him, perhaps as soon as he had made it to Lloyd's gaping, uncomprehending face, he immediately amended.
"They were given you by someone, and you fed them to him to embarrass me."
"I never, sir," Lloyd protested, to no avail. and it annoyed Temeraire so much that he nearly indulged himself in a very small roar. But in the last moment he exercised great restraint and only growled. Sulcombe fled hastily all the same, Lloyd running after him, calling anxiously for the loss of his tip. He had been paid, then, to let Sulcombe come and gawk at Temeraire, as though he really were a circus animal. And Temeraire was only sorry he had not roared, or better yet, thrown them both in the lake. And then his temper faded, and he drooped. He thought, too late, that perhaps he ought to have talked to Sulcombe after all. Lloyd would not read to him, or even tell him anything of the world at all, even if Temeraire asked slowly and clearly enough to be understood, but only said maddeningly, "Now, let's not be worrying ourselves about such things. No sense in getting worked up." Sulcombe, however ignorant, had wished to have a conversation, and he might yet have been prevailed upon to read him something from the latest proceedings, or a newspaper. Oh, what Temeraire would have done for a newspaper! All this time the heavyweight dragons had been finishing their own dinners. The largest, a big, regal copper, spat out a well-chewed grey and blood-stained ball of fleece, belched tremendously and lifted away for his cave. His departure cleared a wide space of the field, and now the rest came in a rush, middleweights and lightweights, and the smaller, courier-weight beasts landing in to take their own share of the sheep and cattle, calling to one another noisily. Temeraire did not move, but only hunched himself a little deeper while they squabbled and played around him, and did not look up even when one, a middleweight, with narrow blue-green legs, set herself directly before him to eat, crunching loudly upon sheep-bones.
"I have been considering the matter," she informed him, after a little while, around a mouthful, "and in all cases, where the angle is 90 degrees, as I suppose you meant to draw it, the length of the longest side must be a number which, multiplied by itself, is equal to the lengths of the two shorter sides each, multiplied by themselves, added."
She swallowed noisily, and licked her chops clean.
"Quite an interesting little observation. How did you come to make it?"
"I never," Temeraire muttered. "It is the Pythagorean theorem. Everyone knows it who is educated. Lawrence taught it me," he added, by way of making himself even more miserable.
"'Hm!'
the other dragon said, rather haughtily, and flew away. But she reappeared at Temeraire's cave the next morning, uninvited, and poked him awake with her nose, saying,
"Perhaps you would be interested to learn that there is a formula which I have invented, which can invariably calculate the power of any sum. What does Pythagoras have to say to that?"
"You never invented it," Temeraire said, irritable at having been woken up early with so empty a day to be faced. "That is the binomial theorem. Yang Hui made it a very long time ago."
And he put his head under his wing and tried to lose himself again in sleep. He thought that would be all. But 4 days later, while he lay by his lake, the strange dragon landed beside him bristling, and announced in a furious rush, her words nearly tumbling over one another in the attempt to get them out,
"There, I have just worked out something quite new. The prime number coming in a particular position, for instance the 10th prime, is always very near the value of that position, multiplied by the exponent one must put on the number p to get that same value. The number p," she added, "being a very curious number, which I have also discovered, and named after myself."
"Certainly not," Temeraire said, rousing with comfortable contempt when he had made sense of what she was talking about. "That is E, and you are talking of the natural logarithm. And as for the rest about prime numbers, it is all nonsense. Only consider the prime 15.
And then he paused, working out the value in his head.
"You see,"
she said triumphantly. And after working out another 24 examples, Temeraire was forced to admit the irritating stranger might indeed be correct.
"And you needn't tell me that this Pythagoras invented it first," the other dragon added, chest puffed out hugely, "or Yang Hui, because I have inquired, and no one ever heard of either of them. They do not live in any of the coverts or breeding grounds, so you may keep your tricks. I thought as much. Whoever heard of a dragon named anything like Yang Hui? Nonsense."
Temeraire was neither despondent nor tired enough in the moment to forget how dreadfully bored he was, and so he was less inclined to take offence.
"He is not a dragon, either of them," he said, "and they are both dead anyway for years and years. Pythagoras was a Greek, and Yang Hui was from China.
"Then how do you know they invented it?"
she demanded suspiciously.
"Lawrence read it me," Temeraire said. "Where did you learn any of it, if not out of books?"
"I worked it out myself," the dragon said. "There is nothing much else to do here."
Her name was Poseitia. She was an experimental crossbreed of a malachite reaper and a lightweight Pascal's blue, who had come out rather larger, slower, and more nervous than the breeders had hoped, and her colouring was not ideal for any sort of camouflage, the body and wings mostly bright blue and streaked with shades of pale green, with widely scattered spines along her back. She was not very old either, unlike most of the once-harnessed dragons in the breeding grounds. She had given up her captain.
"Well," Poseitia said, "I do not mind my captain. He showed me how to do equations when I was small, but I do not see any use in going to war and getting oneself shot at or clawed at for no reason which anyone could explain to me. And when I would not fight, he did not much want me any more."
A statement airily delivered, but Poseitia avoided Temeraire's eyes making it.
"If you mean formation fighting, I do not blame you. It is very tiresome," Temeraire said. "They do not approve of me in China," he added to be sympathetic, "because I do fight. Celestials are not supposed to."
"China must be a very fine place," Poseitia said wistfully,
and Temeraire was by no means inclined to disagree. He thought sadly that if only Lawrence had been willing, they might now be together in Peking, perhaps strolling in the gardens of the summer palace again. He had not had the chance to see it in autumn. And then he paused, and abruptly raising his head, he said,
"You say you made inquiries? What do you mean by that? You cannot have gone out."
"Of course not," Poseitia said. "I gave Monsey half my dinner, and he went to Brecon for me, and put the question out on the courier circuit. This morning he went again, and the word was in no one had ever heard of anybody by those names."
"Oh," Temeraire said, his ruff rising. "Oh, pray, who is Monsey? I will give him anything he likes if only he can find out where Lawrence is. He may have all my dinner for a week."
Monsey was a Winchester, who had slipped the leash and eeled right out of the door of the barn where he had hatched, past a candidate he did not care for, and so made his escape from the corps. He had been coaxed eventually into the breeding grounds more by the promise of company than anything else, being a gregarious creature. Small and dark purplish, he looked like any other Winchester at a distance, and excited no comment if either seen abroad or absent from the daily feeding, and as long as his missed meals were properly compensated for, he was very willing to oblige.
"Hm! How about you give me one of those cows, the nice fat sow they save for you special when you're mating?"
Monsey said.
"I would like to give Lucullah a proper treat,"
he added exultingly.
"Highway robbery!"
Poseitia said indignantly. But Temeraire did not care at all. He was learning, in any case, to hate the taste of the cows, when it meant yet another miserably awkward evening session, and nodded on the bargain.
"But no promises, mind," Monsey cautioned. "I'll put it about, no fears. But it'll be as many as a few weeks to hear back if you want it sorted out proper to all the coverts and to Ireland, and even so maybe no one will have heard anything."
"There is sure to have been word," Temeraire said, low, "if he is dead."
The ball came in down the ship's bows and crashed recklessly the length of the lower deck, the drum roll of its passage preceding it with castanets of splinters raining against the walls for accompaniment. The young marine guarding the brig had been trembling since the call to go to quarters had sounded above, a mingling, Lawrence thought, of anxiety and the desire to be doing something, and the frustration at being kept at so useless and miserable a post, a sentiment he shared from his still more useless place within the cell. The ball seemed only to be rolling at a leisurely pace by the time it approached the brig, and offered a first opportunity. The marine had put out his foot to stop it, before Lawrence could say a word. He had seen much the same impulse have much the same result on other battlefields. The ball took off the better part of the foot, and continued unperturbed into and through the metal grating, skewing the door off its top hinge and finally embedding itself 2 inches deep into the solid oak wall of the ship, there remaining. Lawrence pushed the crazily swinging door open and climbed out of the brig, taking off his neckcloth to tie the marine's foot. The young man was staring, amazed at the bloody stump, and needed a little coaxing to limp along to the orlop.
"A clean shot. I'm sure the rest will come off nicely," Lawrence said for comfort,
and left him to the surgeons. The steady roar of cannon fire was going on overhead. He went up the stern ladderway and plunged into the roaring confusion of the gun deck, daylight shining in from her east-pointed bows through jagged, gaping holes and making a glittering cloud of the smoke and dust kicked up from the cannon. Roaring Martha had jumped her tackling, and five men were fighting to hold her weighed against the roll of the ship long enough to get her secure again. At any moment the gun might go running wild across the deck, crushing men and perhaps smashing through the side.
"There, girl! Hold fast! Hold fast!"
The captain of the gun crew was speaking to her like a skittish horse, his hands wincing away from the barrel, smoking hot. One side of his face was bristling with splinters standing out like hedgehog spines. In the smoke, in the red light, no one knew Lawrence. He was only another pair of hands. He had his flight gloves still in his coat pocket. He clapped onto the metal with them and pushed her by the mouth of the barrel, his palms stinging even through the thick leather, and with a final thump, she heaved over into the grooves again. The men tied her down and then stood around her, trembling like well-run horses, panting and sweating. There was no return firing. No calls passed along from the quarter-deck. No ship in view through the gunport. The ship was griping furiously where Lawrence put his hand on the side, a sort of low, moaning complaint, as if she were trying to go too close to the wind, and water was glubbing in a curious way against her sides, a sound wholly unfamiliar. And he knew this ship. He had served on Goliath 4 years in her midshipman's mess as a boy, as lieutenant for another 2, and at the Battle of the Nile. He would have said he could recognize every note of her voice. He put his head out the porthole and saw the enemy crossing their bows and turning to come about for another pass. A frigate only, a beautiful, trim 36-gun ship which could have thrown not half of Goliath's broadside. An absurd combat on the face of it, and he could not understand why they had not turned to rake her across the stern. Instead, there was only a little grumbling from the bow chasers above, not much reply to be making. Looking forward along the ship, he saw that she had been pierced by an enormous harpoon sticking through her side as if she were a whale. At the end, inside the ship, had several ingeniously curved barbs, which had been jerked sharply back to dig into the wood, and the cable at the harpoon's other end swung grandly up and up and up into the air, where 2 enormous heavyweight dragons were holding on to it, an older Parnassian, likely traded to France during an earlier peacetime, and a Grand Chevalier. It was not the only harpoon. 3 more cable lines dangled down from their grip to the bow, and another 2 from the stern that Lawrence could see. The dragons were too far aloft for him to make out the details, with the ship's motion underneath him, but the cables were somehow laced into their harnesses, and merely by flying together and pulling, they were pivoting the ship's head into the wind. All her sails must have been taken aback, and the dragons were too far aloft for round shot to reach them. One of them sneezed from the action of the frantically speaking pepper guns, but they had only to beat their wings a little more to get away from the pepper, hauling the ship along while they did it.
"Axes! Axes!"
the lieutenant was shouting, with a clattering of iron as the boatswain's mates came spilling weapons across the floor. Hand axes, cutlasses, knives. The men snatched them up and began to reach out the portholes to try and hack the ship free, but the harpoons were 2 foot long from the hook, and the ropes had enough slackness to give no good purchase to their efforts. Someone would have to climb out of a porthole to saw at them, open and exposed against the hull of the ship, with the frigate coming round again. No one moved to go, at first. Then Lawrence reached out and took a short cutlass sharpened from the heap. The lieutenant looked into his face and knew him, but said nothing. Turning to the porthole, Lawrence worked his shoulders through and pulled himself out, many hands quickly coming beneath his feet to support him, and the lieutenant calling again. Shortly, a rope was flung down to him from the deck above so he could brace himself against the hull. Many faces were peering over at him anxiously, strangers. Then another man came sliding down over the rail, and another to work on the other harpoons. Lawrence began the grim effort of sawing away at the cable, strands going one at a time. The rope was cable-laid, 3 hawsers of 3 strands, well-wormed and thick as a man's wrist and parcelled in canvas, and meanwhile he made a bright target against the ship's paintwork for the guns of the frigate. If he were killed, the embarrassment of his hanging would at least be spared his family. He was only alive now to be a chain round Temeraire's neck until the Admiralty should decide the dragon pacified enough by age and habit that Lawrence might be dispensed with and his sentence carried out. And that might be years, long years, mouldering in jail or in the bowels of a ship. It was not a purposeful thought, no guilty intention. It only crossed his mind involuntarily while he worked. He had his back to the ocean, could not see anything of the frigate or the larger battle beyond. His horizon was the splintered paint of Goliath's side, lacquered shine made rough by splinters and salt, and the cold sea was climbing up her hull and spraying his back. Distant roars of cannon fire spoke, but Goliath had let her guns fall silent, saving her powder and shot for when they should be of some use. The loudest noises in his ears were the grunts and effort of the men hanging nearby, sawing at their own harpoon lines. Then one of them gave a startled yell and let go his rope, falling away into the churning ocean. A small, darting courier beast, a chasseur vocifère, was plunging at the side of the ship with another harpoon. The beast held it something like a jouster in a medieval tournament, with the butt rigged awkwardly into a cup attached to its harness for support, and two men on its back bracing the rig. The harpoon thumped dully against the ship's side, near to where Lawrence hung, and the dragon's tail slapped a wash of salt water up into his face, heavy, stinging thickness in his nostrils and dripping down the back of his throat as he choked it out. The dragon lunged away again, even as the marines fired off a furious volley, trailing the harpoon on its line behind it. The barb had not bitten deep enough to penetrate. The hull was pockmarked with the dents of earlier attempts, a good dozen for each planted harpoon marring her spit-and-polish paintwork. Lawrence wiped salt from his face against his arm and shouted, "Keep working, man, damn you!" at the other seaman still hanging near him. The first rope of his own cable was gone at last, tough fibres fraying away from the cutlass edge and fanning out like a broom. He began on the second, rapidly, although the blade was going dull. The frigate was still there to harass them, and he could not help but look around at the roar of cannon so nearby. A ball came whistling across the water, skipping two, three times along the wave-tops like a stone thrown by a boy. It looked as though it came straight for him. An illusion. The whole ship groaned as the ball punched in at the bows, and splinters flew like a sudden blizzard out of the open portholes. They peppered Lawrence's legs, stinging like a flock of bees, and his stockings were quickly wet with blood. He clung on to the harpoon arm and kept sawing. The frigate was still firing, broadside rolling on, and the round shot hurtled at them again and again. A sickening, deep sway to Goliath's motion now as she took the pounding. He had to hand the cutlass back in and shout for a fresh to get through the last strand. Then at last the cable was cut loose, and swinging away free, and they pulled him back in. He staggered when he tried to stand and went to his knees, slipping in blood, stockings laddered and soaked through red. His best breeches, still the same ones he had worn for the trial, were pierced and spotted. He was helped to sit against the wall and turned the cutlass on his own shirt for bandages to tie up the worst of the gashes. No one could be spared to help him to the surgeon's. The other harpoons had been cut. They were moving at last, coming around, and all the crews were fixed by their guns, savage in the dim red glow penetrating, teeth bared and mazed with blood from cracked lips and gums, faces black with sweat and grime, ready to take vengeance. A loud pattering like rain or hailstones came suddenly down, small bombs with short fuses dropped by the French dragons, flashes like lightning visible through the boards of the deck. Some rolled down through the ladderways and burst in the gun deck. Hot flash-powder smoke and the burning glare of pyrotechnics, painful to the eyes. Then they hove around in view of the frigate, and the order came down to fire! Fire! There was nothing for a long moment but the mindless fury of the ship's guns going. Impossible to think in that roaring din. Smoke and hellish fire in her bowels choking away all reason. Lawrence reached out for the porthole, which they had paused, and hauled himself up to look. The French frigate was reeling away under the pounding, her foremast down and hulled below the waterline, so each wave slapping away poured into her. There was no cheering. Past the retreating frigate, the breadth of the channel spread open before them, and all the great ships of the blockade entangled and harassed just as they had been. The Abukir and the mighty Sultan, 74 guns, were near enough to recognize, cables rising up to 3 and 4 dragons, French heavyweights and middleweights industriously tugging every which way. The ships were firing steadily but uselessly, clouds of smoke that did not reach the dragons above. And between them, half a dozen French ships of the line, come out of harbour at last, were stately going by, escort to an enormous flotilla. 100 and more barges and fishing boats, and even rafts in lateen rig, all of them crammed with soldiers, the wind at their backs, and the tide carrying them towards the shore, tricolours streaming proudly from their bows towards England. With the navy paralysed, only the dragons of the corps were left to stop the advance. But the French warships were firing regularly into the air above the flotilla, something like pepper in vaster quantities than could have been afforded of spice, and burning. Red spark fragments glowed like fireflies against the black smoke cloud which hung over the boats, shielding them from aerial attack. One of the transport boats was near enough that Lawrence saw the men had their faces covered with wet kerchiefs and rags, or huddled under oilcloth sheets. The British dragons made desperate attempts to dive, but recoiled from the clouds and had instead to fling down bombs from too great a height, 10 splashing into the wide ocean for every one which came near enough to make a wave against the ship's hull. The smaller French dragons harried them too, flying back and forth and jeering in shrill voices. There were so many of them. Lawrence had never seen so many. Wheeling almost like birds, clustering and breaking apart, offering no easy target to the British dragons in their stately formations. One great regal copper might have been Maximus, red and orange and yellow against the blue sky, at the head of a formation with yellow reapers in 2 lines to his either wing, but Lawrence did not see Lily. The regal roared, audible faintly even over the distance, and bowled his formation through 12 French lightweights to come at a great French warship. Flames bloomed from her sails as the bombs at last hit, but when the formation rose away again, one of the reapers was streaming crimson from its belly, and another was listing. A handful of British frigates, too, were valiantly trying to dash past the French ships to come at the transports. With some little success, but they were under heavy fire, and if they sank 12 boats, half the men were pulled aboard others, so close were the little transports to one another. "Every man to his gun!" the lieutenant said sharply. Goliath was turning to go after the transports. She would be passing between Magister and Eros, a broadside of nearly 3 tons between them. Lawrence felt it when her sails caught the wind properly again, the ship leaping forward like an eager racehorse held too long. She had made all sail. He touched his leg. The blood had stopped flowing, he thought. He limped back to an empty place at a gun. Outside, the first transports were already hurtling themselves onward to the shore, lightweight dragons wheeling above to shield them while they ran artillery onto the ground, and one soldier rammed the standard into the dirt, the golden eagle atop catching fire with the sunlight. Napoleon had landed in England at last. Chapter 2. The question sent out, Temeraire found it was almost worse to have the prospect of an answer, to know that there was an answer and that it would reach him soon. Before, the world itself had been undecided if Lawrence was still in it. He might as easily be alive as not, and so long as Temeraire did not know otherwise, Lawrence was alive at least in part, which was almost all which could be hoped for. The news at best would only be that he was still imprisoned. As the day crept onward, Temeraire began to feel certainty was a weak reward to repay the risk of receiving the dreadful contrary answer, a possibility which Temeraire could not bear to envision. A great blankness engulfed him if he tried, like a grey sky full of clouds above, and below, fog all around. He wanted distraction badly, and there was none, except to talk to Pasaitia, which was at least interesting, if from time to time infuriating also. Pasaitia liked to think herself a great genius, and she was certainly unusually clever, even if she could not quite grasp the notion of writing. Occasionally, to Temeraire's discomfiture, she would leap quite far ahead and come out with some strange notion which was in none of the books Temeraire had read, but which could not at all be disproved or quarrelled with. But she was so jealous of her discoveries that she flew into a temper when Temeraire could inform her that any of them had been made before, and she was resentful of the hierarchy of the breeding grounds, which, as she saw it, denied her the just deserts of her brilliance. Because of her middling size, she had to make do with an inconvenient, pokey clearing down in the moorlands, of which she complained endlessly. No prospect, and little more than an overhang to shelter from the rain.
"So why do you not take a better?" Temeraire said, exasperated. "There are several very nice, directly over there, in the cliff face. You would be much more comfortable there, I am sure."
"One does not like to be quarrelsome,"
Persaetia said, evasive and entirely false. She liked very well to be quarrelsome, and Temeraire did not understand what that had to do with taking an empty cave either, but at least it diverted the subject. The only event of note was that it rained for a week without stopping, with a steady driving wind behind it, which came into all the cave mouths and permeated the ground and made everyone perfectly miserable. Temeraire was very glad of his antechamber, where he could shake off the water and dry before retreating to the comfort of his larger chamber. Several of the smallest dragons, courier waits living in the hollows by the river, were flooded out of their homes entirely. Sorry for their muddy and bedraggled state, Temeraire invited them to stop in his cavern while the rain continued, so long as they first washed off the mud. They were loud with appreciation for his arrangements, gratifyingly, and a few days later, while he was brooding, anxious and solitary once again over Lawrence, a shadow crossed over the mouth of his cave. It was the big, regal copper Requiescat. He ducked in through the antechamber and came into Temeraire's main chamber, uninvited, and gazed around the room with a pleased air, nodding, and said,
"It is just as nice as they said."
"Thank you," Temeraire said,
thawed a little by the compliment, although he did not much want company just then. And then he remembered he must be polite.
"Will you sit down? I am sorry I cannot offer you tea."
"Tea?" Requiescat said, but absently, not expecting an answer. He was poking his nose into the corners of the cave, even putting his tongue out to smell them, Temeraire saw indignantly, as if he were at home. Temeraire's ruff began to try and bristle.
"I beg your pardon," he said stiffly. "I am afraid you have found me unprepared for guests,"
which he thought was a clever way of hinting that Requiescat might go away again any time he chose. But the regal copper did not take the hint, or at any rate he did not choose to go, but instead settled himself comfortably along the back of the cave and said,
"Well, old fellow, I'm afraid we will have to swap."
"Swap?"
Temeraire said, puzzled, until he divined that Requiescat meant caves.
"I do not want your cave," adding hastily. "Not that it is not very nice, I am sure, but I have just got this one arranged to suit me."
"This one is much bigger now,"
Requiescat explained, or by his tone thought he was explaining,
"and it is much nicer in the wet. Mine," he added regretfully, "has been full of puddles all this week, wet clear through to the back."
"Then I can hardly see why I would change,"
Temeraire said, still more baffled, and then he sat up, outraged and astonished, and let his ruff spread fully as it had so wanted to do.
"Why, you are a damned scrub," he said. "How dare you come here and behave like a visitor, and all the time it is a challenge. I never saw anything so sly in my life. It is the sort of thing Lien would do, I suppose," he added cuttingly, "and you may get out at once. If you want my cave, you may try and take it. I will meet you any time you like, now or at dawn tomorrow."
"Now, now, let us not get excited," Requiescat said pacifyingly. "I can see you are a young fellow, right enough. A challenge, really. It is nothing of the sort. I am the most peaceable fellow in the world, and I do not want to fight anyone. I am sorry if I was ham-handed about it. It is not that I want to take your cave, you see."
Temeraire did not see, in the least.
"It is a question of appearances. Here you are a month, with the nicest cave, and you know where the biggest, either.
Requiescat preened his own side a little. Certainly he outweighed any dragon Temere had seen but Maximus and Litificat.
"We have our own little ways here of arranging things to keep everyone comfortable. No one wants any fighting to cut up our peace, not when there is no need. It would be a nasty-tempered sort of fellow who would get to fighting over one cave versus another, both of them large and handsome enough for anyone. But distinctions must be preserved."
"Stuff," Temere said. "It sounds to me like you have got so lazy, having all your meals given you and nothing to do, that you do not even want to put yourself to the trouble of properly bullying other people. Or maybe," he added, having made up his mind to be really insulting, "you are just a coward, and thought I was the same. Well, I am not, and I am not going to give you my cave either, no matter what you do."
Requiescat did not rise to the remarks, but only shook his head dolefully.
"There, I am not a clever chap, so I have made a mull of explaining, and now your back is put up. I suppose we will have to get the council together, or you will never believe me. It is a bother, but it is your right after all."
He heaved himself back up to his feet and added infuriatingly,
"You may keep the place until then. It will take me a day or so to get word to everyone."
Before he padded out again, leaving Temeraire quivering with rage.
"His cave is the nicest," Pasitia said anxiously later. "At least, certainly we have always thought so. I am sure you would like it, and maybe you could make it even more pleasant than this. Why don't you go and see first before fighting him?"
"I do not care if it is Ali Baba's cave, and full of gold and lamps,"
Temeraire said, not trying to master his temper. It was better to be angry than miserable, and he was glad of anything to think about instead of what he could do nothing to repair.
"It is a question of principle. I am not going to be bullied as though I were not up to his weight. If I made the other cave nice, he should only try to take that back, I am sure. Or some other dragon would try and push me out. No, thank you. Who are this council?"
"It is the biggest dragons," Pasitia said, "and a long wing, although Gentius does not bother to come out much any more."
"All of them his friends, I suppose," Temeraire said.
"No one much likes Requiescat," Monsi said, perched on the lip of Temeraire's cave. "He eats too much and will never take less, even if it's short commons all around. But he is the biggest, and so there shouldn't be fighting. The general rule is that caves go by who is strongest if there is any quarrel, and no one is allowed to take a place out of his class, or others will get jealous and squabble." "You see, it is just as I told you. All unfairness," Pasitia said bitterly. "As if the only quality of any importance were one's weight, or how good one is at scratching and biting and kicking up a fuss, never any consideration for really remarkable qualities."
"I will allow it to have some practical sense," Temeraire said, "as a way to choose caves. But it is nonsense that after I have taken one, which he might have had at any moment before I came, and did not want, that he should be able to snatch it from me after I have gone to so much trouble to make it nice. And he is not stronger than me either, if he does weigh more. I should like to know if he has sunk a frigate alone with a fleur-de-nuit on his back. And as for distinction, my ancestors were scholars in China, while his were starving in pits."
"That's as may be. But he knows all the council, and you don't," Monsi said practically. "You ain't going to fight a dozen heavyweights at once. And beg pardon, but no one looking at you would say, 'Right-o, there's a match for old Requiescat.' Not that you are little, but you are a bit skinny-looking."
"I am not, am I?"
Temeraire said, craning his head anxiously to look back at himself. He did not have spines along his back, the way Maximus or Requiescat did, but he was sleek. He was perhaps a bit long for his weight, by British standards.
"But anyway, he is not a fire-breather, or an acid-spitter."
"Are you?" Monsi inquired.
"No," Temeraire said, "but I have the divine wind. Lawrence says it is even better."
However, it belatedly occurred to him that perhaps Lawrence might have been speaking partially. Certainly Monsi and Pasitia looked blank, and it was difficult to explain just how it operated.
"I roar in a particular sort of way. I have to breathe quite deeply, and there is a clenching feeling along the throat, and then it makes things break, trees and so on."
Temeraire finished in an ashamed mutter, conscious that it sounded very dull and useless when so described.
"It is very unpleasant to be caught in it," he added defensively. "At least, so I understand, from how others have acted, if they are before me, when I use it."
"How interesting," Poseidia said politely. "I have often wondered what sound is, exactly. We ought to do some experiments."
"Experiments ain't going to help you with the council," Monsi said.
Temre switched his tail against his side, thinking, and then he said with distaste,
"No, I see that. It is all politics. It is plain to me. I must work out what Lien would do."
He cornered Lloyd the next morning and said,
"Lloyd, I am very hungry today. May I have an extra cow to take up to my cave?"
"There, that is a little more like," Lloyd said approvingly,
not deaf at all to a request so satisfactory to his own ideas of dragon husbandry. He ordered it directly, and while waiting, Temere asked, attempting an air casual, as though he were only making conversation,
"I do not suppose you might recall who Gentius has sired?"
The old Longwing cracked a bleary eye when Temere landed and peered at him rather incuriously.
"Yes,"
he said. His cave was not so large, but a comfortable dry hollow tucked well under the mountainside, on higher ground overlooking a curve of the creek, so he might merely creep downhill for a drink without flying, and then back up to a large flat rock full in the sun, where he presently lay napping.
"I beg your pardon for not coming by before, sir," Temere said, inclining his head, "to visit you. I have served with Excidium these last 3 years at Dover. Your third hatchling," he added, when Gentius looked vague.
"Yes, Excidium, of course,"
Gentius said, his tongue licking the air experimentally, and Temere laid down before him the cow, butchered with the help of Monsi's small claws to take out the large bones.
"A small gift to show my respect," Temere said,
and Gentius brightened.
"Why, that is tres genteel of you,"
he said with atrocious pronunciation, which Temere just in time remembered not to correct, and took the cow into his mouth to gum at it slowly with the wobbly remainder of his teeth.
"Very kind, as my first captain liked to say,"
Gentius mumbled reminiscently around it.
"You might go in there and bring out her picture," he added, "if you are very careful with it."
The portrait was rather odd and flat-looking, and the woman in it very plain, even before time and the elements had faded her. But it was in a really splendid golden frame, so large and thick that Temere could take it delicately between two talon tips to lift it and carry it out into the sun.
"How beautiful!" he said sincerely,
holding it where Gentius could at least point his head in its direction, although his eyes were so milky with cataracts he could not have seen it as more than a blur in the golden square.
"Charming woman," Gentius said sadly. "She fed me my first bright, fresh liver when my head was no bigger than her hand. One never quite gets over the first, you know."
"Yes,"
Temere said low, and looked away unhappily. At least Gentius had not had her taken from him and put who knew where. When he had put the portrait back with equal care and listened to a long story about one of the wars in which Gentius had fought, something with the Prussians, where pepper guns had been invented, very unpleasant things, especially when one had not been expecting them at all, then Gentius was quite ready to be sympathetic and to shake his head censoriously over Requiescat's behaviour.
"No proper manners these days. That is what it is."
"I am very glad to hear you say so. That is just what I thought, but as I am quite young, I did not feel sure of myself without advice from someone wiser, like yourself," Temere said, and then with sudden inspiration added, "I suppose next he will propose that if any of us have some treasure which he likes, gold or jewels, we must give it to him. It follows quite plainly."
That was indeed enough to rouse Gentius up, with so handsome a treasure of his own to consider.
"I do not see that you are wrong at all," he said darkly. "Of course we cannot have Winchesters taking caves fit for regal coppers. There would be no end of trouble and quarrelling. and then sooner or later the men will involve themselves and make it all even worse. They think somehow reapers are less use than angle-wings because there are more of them and they are clannish instead of the other way round, and they have many more such odd notions. But that is not the same as taking away a cave perfectly suitable to your weight and standing.
He paused and said delicately,
I do not suppose you had a formation of your own.
No, Temeraire said, at least not officially. Although Arcady and the others fought under my orders, and I was wingmates with Maximus, he is Litificat's hatchling.
Litificat, yes. Fine dragon,
Gentius said.
I served with her, you know, in 76. We had a dust-up with the colonials at Boston. They got artillery above our positions.
Temeraire came away eventually, with Gentius's firm promise to attend the council meeting, and returned to his cave well pleased with the success of his first efforts.
"Who else is on the council?" he asked.
While Poseidia began listing off names, Reedley, a mongrel half-Winchester with yellow streaks, piped up from the corner,
"You ought to speak to Magistatus!"
Poseidia bristled at once.
"I see no reason why he ought to do any such thing. Magistatus is a very common sort of dragon, and he is not on the council anyway." "He made sure I got a share of the food when we were all sick, and things were short,"
Minnow said, on the other side. She was a muddy-coloured feral with touches of grey copper and sharp spitter, and even a little garde de lion, which had given her vivid orange eyes and blue spots to set off her otherwise drab colouring. A low murmur of general agreement went around. A crowd had gradually accumulated in Temeraire's cave to offer their advice and remarks, a good many of the smaller dragons having interested themselves in Temeraire's case, those he had sheltered and their acquaintance, and besides them the not insignificant number who had some injury, real or imagined, to lay at Requiescat's door.
"And he is not in the council only because he does not care to be. He is a Parnassian," she added to Temeraire.
"If he were a flamme de gloire, it would hardly signify," Poseidia said coldly,
"as he does nothing but sleep all the time."
Monse nudged Temeraire with his head and murmured,
"Corrected her once, 6 years ago." "It was only an error of arithmetic," Poseidia said heatedly. "I should have found it out myself in a moment. I was only occupied with a much more important question." "Where does he live?"
Temeraire asked, interrupting. He felt that anyone who did not have time for politics must be rather sensible. Magistatus was indeed sleeping when Temeraire came to see him. His cave was out of the way and not very large, but Temeraire noticed that there was a carefully placed heap of stones along the back, which blocked one's view into the interior. If he widened his pupils as far as they would go, he thought he could make out a darker space behind them, as if there were a passageway going back deeper into the mountainside. He coiled himself neatly and waited without fidgeting, as was polite, but at length, when Magistatus showed no signs of waking, after 10 minutes, or perhaps five, very nearly five, Temeraire coughed. Then he coughed again, a little more emphatically, and Magistatus sighed and said, without opening his eyes,
"So you are not leaving, I suppose?"
"Oh," Temeraire said, his ruff prickling, "I thought you were only sleeping, not ignoring me deliberately. I will go at once."
"Well, you might as well stay
now," Magistatus said, lifting his head and yawning himself awake. "I don't bother to wake up if it isn't important enough to wait for, that's all." "That is sensible, I suppose, if you like to sleep better than to have a conversation," Temeraire said dubiously.
"You'll like it better in a few years yourself," Magistatus said.
"No, I do not suppose I will," Temeraire said. "At least, the Analects say the superior dragon does not sleep more than 14 hours of the day, so I shan't. Unless," he added desolately, "I am still shut up in here, where there is nothing worth doing."
"If you think so, what are you doing here instead of in the coverts?" Magistatus said.
He listened to the explanation with the same casual sympathy of one hearing a storyteller, which Temeraire was beginning to expect, and passed no judgment, other than to nod equably and say,
"A bad lot for you, poor worm."
"Why have you come here?" Temeraire ventured. "You are not very old yourself. Do you really like to sleep so much? You might have a captain and be in battles."
Magistatus shrugged with one wingtip, flared and folded down again.
"Had one,
mislaid him.
Mislaid? Temeraire said.
Well, Magistatis said, I left him in a water trough, and I don't suppose he is still sitting there, so I have no notion where he has got to.
He was not inclined to be very enthusiastic. When Temeraire had explained, he sighed and said,
You are young to be making such a fuss out of it.
If I am, Temeraire retorted, at least I am not complacent, and ready to let this sort of bullying go on when I can do something about it, and I do not mean to be satisfied, he added, with a pointed look at the back of Magistatus's cave, to arrange matters better only for myself.
Magistatus's eyes slitted narrow, but he did not stir otherwise.
It seems to me you are as likely to make it worse for everyone. There's no wrangling now, at least, and no one is getting hurt.
No one is very comfortable either, Temeraire said. We all might have nicer places, but no one will work to improve theirs if they know it may be taken away from them at any time, because they have made it nice. Once a cave is yours, it ought to be yours, like property.
The council looked a little dubious at this argument when Temeraire repeated it to them the next afternoon. The rain at last had broken early that morning before a strong westerly wind sweeping the clouds scudding before it, and they had gathered in a great clearing among the mountains, full of pleasant, broad, smooth-topped rocks warmed by the sun. Magistatus had come after all, and Gentius, although the old dragon was mostly asleep after the effort of making the flight, curled upon the blackest rock and murmuring occasionally to himself. Requiescat sprawled inelegantly across half the length of the clearing, making himself look very large. Temeraire disdained the attempt and kept himself neatly coiled, with his ruff spread proudly, although he privately wished he might have had his talon sheaths, and even a headdress such as he had seen in some of the markets along the old silk caravan roads. He was sure that could not fail to impress. Ballista, a big checkered nettle, thumped her barbed tail on the ground several times to silence the muttering which had arisen amongst the council in the middle of Temeraire's remarks.
"And if we agree," Temeraire went on valiantly in the face of so much scepticism, "that everyone may keep their own cave when they have got it, I would be very happy to show anyone the trick of arranging them better, so you all may have nicer caves if you only take a little trouble to make them so."
"Very nice, I am sure," one peevish older Parnassian said, "if you are a yearling to be fussing with rocks and twigs."
There were several snorts of agreement, and Temeraire bristled.
"If you do not care to, and you are happy with your cave as it is, then you needn't. But neither ought you go and take someone else's cave when they have done all the work. Certainly I'm not going to be robbed as if I were a lump. I will smash the cave up myself and make it not at all nice for anyone before I hand it over meekly."
Now then," Ballista said, "there is no call to go yelling about smashing things or making threats. That is enough of that. Now we'll hear Requiescat." "Quarrelsome, ain't he?" Requiescat said. "Well, you all know me, chums, and I don't mean to make a brag of myself, but I expect no one would say I couldn't take any cave I liked if I wanted to. I'm not a squabbler, and don't like to hurt anybody. A young fellow like this is excitable enough to bite off a bigger fight than he can swallow."
"Oh," Temeraire said indignantly, "you mayn't claim any such thing unless you like to prove it. I have beat dragons nearly as big as you."
Requiescat swung his big head around.
"Ain't it true you're bred not to fight? Percy was going about saying some such."
Persaetia gave an angry yelp of, "I never!" stifled quickly by the other small dragon sitting around her at Ballista's censorious glare.
"Celestials," Temeraire said very coolly, "are bred to be the very best sort of dragon. In China we are not supposed to fight unless the nation is in danger, because China has a good deal many more dragons than here, and we are too valuable to lose, so we only fight in emergencies, when ordinary fighting dragons are not up to the task."
"Oh, China," Requiescat said dismissively. "Anyway, fellows, there you have it, plain as day. I say I am tops and ought to have the best cave. He says it ain't so, and he won't hand it over. Ordinary, there'd be no ways to work that out but a tussle, and then someone gets hurt and everyone is upset.
This is just the sort of thing the council was made up for, and I expect it ought to be pretty clear to all of you which of us is right without it coming to claws.
I do not say I am tops, Temeraire said, although I think it just as likely that I am. I say that the cave is mine, and it is unjust for you to take it. That is what the council ought to be for. Justice, not squashing everyone down just to keep things comfortable for the biggest dragons.
The council, being composed of the biggest dragons, did not look very enthusiastic. Ballista said,
All right, we have heard everyone out. Now look, Temeraire, she pronounced it quite wrongly, we don't want a lot of fuss and bother.
I do not see why not, Temeraire said. What else have we to do?
Several of the smaller dragons tittered, rustling their wings together. She cleared her throat warningly at them and continued.
We don't want a lot of fighting, anyhow. Why don't you just go on and show us a bit of flying, so we know what you can do? Then we can settle this clear.
But that is not at all the point, Temeraire said. If I were as small as Monsi...
He looked, but Monsi was not among the little dragons observing, so he amended.
If I were as small as Minnow there, it oughtn't make any difference. No one was using it, no one wanted it, not before I had it.
Requiescat gave a flip of his wings.
It was not the nicest before,
he said in reasonable tones. Temeraire snorted angrily, but Ballista said impatiently,
Yes, yes, go on then, unless you don't like us to see.
And that was too much to bear. He threw himself aloft, spiralling high and fast as he could, tightening into a spring, and then dived directly into formation manoeuvres. That was what would please them, he thought bitterly. He finished the training pass and backwinged directly into the reverse, flying the pattern backwards, and then hovered mid-air before descending straight downwards, showing away, of course, but they had demanded he do so, and landing he announced,
I will show you the divine wind now. But you had all better clear away from that rock wall, as I expect a lot of it will come down.
There was a good deal of grumbling as the big dragons shifted themselves with dragging tails and annoyed looks. Temeraire ignored them and breathed in very deeply several times, stretching his chest wide. He meant to do as much damage as he could. He noticed in belated dismay, though, that the face of the rock wall was not loose, or even the nice soft white limestone in the caves which crumbled so conveniently. He nosed out to it and scraped a claw down the face. He barely left white scratches on the hard grey rock.
Well, Ballista said, we're all waiting.
There was no help for it. Temeraire backed away from the cliff and drew breath, preparatory. And then there was a hurried rush of wings above. Monsi dropped into the clearing beside him, panting, and said,
Call it off! It's all off!
Urgently to Ballista.
Hey, what's this then? Requiescat said, frowning.
"'Quiet, you fat lump!'
Monsi said, slitting a good many eyes. He was not much bigger than the regal copper's head.
"'I'm fresh from Brecken. The frogs have come over the channel!'
A great, confused babble arose all around. Even Gentius roused with a low hiss, and while everyone spoke at once, Monsi turned to Temeraire and said,
"'Listen, you're Lawrence. Word is in they locked him up on a ship called the Goliath.'
"'The Goliath!' Temeraire said. "'I know that ship.' Lawrence has spoken of it to me before. That is very good. That is splendid. It is on blockade. I know just where it is, nearly, and I'm sure anyone at Dover can tell me exactly where...
Oh, fellow, I wish I needn't pop it out so, but there's no good way to say it,
Monsi said.
The frogs sank her this morning coming across. She's at the bottom of the ocean, and not a man got off her before she went down.
Temeraire did not say anything. A terrible sensation was rising, climbing up his throat. He turned blindly away to let it come. The roar, bursting out like the roll of thunder overhead, silencing every word around him, and the wall of stone cracked open before him like a pane of mirrored glass.
Chapter 3 They pulled the ship's boats into Dover Harbour past 11 o'clock at night, sweating underneath their chilled, wet clothing, hands blistered on the oars. They climbed out, shivering, onto the docks. Captain Puget handed up in a litter, almost senseless with blood loss, and Lieutenant Fry, 19, the only one left to oversee. The rest of the senior officers were all dead. Fry looked at Lawrence with great uncertainty and glanced around. The men offered him nothing. beaten down with rowing and defeat. Silent. At last, Lawrence said quietly to the young man, "The Port Admiral," prompting. And Fry coloured and said to a gangly young midshipman, clearing his throat,
"You had better take the prisoner to the Port Admiral, Mr. Mead, and let him decide what is to be done."
With two marines for guards, Lawrence went with Mead along the dockside streets to the Port Admiral's office, where they found nearly more confusion than had been on the deck of the Goliath in her last moments, after the double broadside had dismasted her. Smoke everywhere, fire crawling steadily down through the ship towards the powder magazine, and cannon running wild back and forth on her decks. Here, instead, the hallways were thick with unchecked speculation.
500,000 men landed, one man said in the hallway, a ridiculous number, inflated by panic, without common sense.
Already in London, said another, and 10 millions in shipping seized.
The very last of these, the only plausible suggestion. If Bonaparte had captured one or two of the ports on the Thames estuary and taken the merchantmen there, he might indeed have reached something like that number. An enormous collection of prizes to fuel the invasion already begun, like coal heaped into a burning stove.
"I do not give a damn if you take him out and lynch him, only get him out of my sight," the Port Admiral said furiously,
when Mead finally managed to work his way through the press and ask him for orders. There was a vast roaring noise outside the windows, like the wind rising in a storm, even though the night was clear. More petitioners were shoving frantically past them, so Lawrence had to catch Mead by the arm and hold him up as they were carried away. The boy could scarcely have been 14, and was a little underfed. Set adrift, Mead looked helplessly. Lawrence wondered if he should have to find his own prison and lock himself into it. But then one young lieutenant pushed through towards him, flung him a look of flat contempt, and said,
"That is the traitor, is it? This way, and you two damn dogs take a proper hold of him before he crawls away in this press."
He took up an old truncheon in the hallway, left from some press gang, perhaps, and swinging it to clear the way, took them out into the street, Mead trotting gratefully after. He brought them to an old run-down sponging house 2 streets away, with bars upon the windows and a mastiff tied in the barren yard, howling unhappily to add to the clamour of the uneasy, half-rioting crowd. Beating upon the door brought out the master of the house, who whined objections which the lieutenant overruled one after another, and at last defeated entirely by pushing in upon him.
"There, and better than you deserve," he said to Lawrence coldly,
having taken them up to the small and squalid attic and held open the door. He was a slight young man, with a struggling moustache, and a solid push would have served to lay him out upon the unkempt floor. Lawrence looked at him a moment, and then went inside, stooping under the lintel. The door was shut upon him. Through the wall he heard the lieutenant ordering the 2 marines to stay and stand watch, and the owner's complaints trailing him back down the stairs. It was bitterly cold. The irregular floor of warped and knotted boards felt strange under Lawrence's feet, still expecting the listing motion of the ship. There was a handkerchief square of a window for air and light, which at present let in only the thick smell of smoke, and a reddish glow shining on the undersides of the rooftops, all that he could see. Lawrence sat down on the narrow cot and looked at his hands. There would be fighting by now all along the coast. Men landed at Deal, and likely along points north, all around the mouth of the Thames. Not 500,000, nothing like, but enough, perhaps. It would not take a very large company of infantry to establish a secure beachhead, secure enough, and then Napoleon could land men as quick as he could get them across the channel. This, Lawrence would have said, could be not very quickly, not in the face of the navy. But that opinion fell before the manoeuvres he had witnessed today. Pitting great numbers of lightweights, easy to feed and quick to manoeuvre, against the British heavyweights, in the face of all common wisdom, and using the massed power of their own heavyweights instead against the ships, the British point of strength. It bore the same tactical stamp as the whirling attack which he had seen at the Battle of Jena, spearheaded there by Lienne, and Lawrence had no doubt her advice had served Napoleon in this latest adventure. Lawrence had reported on the Battle of Jena to the Admiralty. It was a bitter thought to consider that his treason must have undermined that intelligence, and likely discredited all his reports. Jane, at least, he had thought, had hoped, would still have kept it under consideration, even if she had not forgiven, would have understood him so far to know that his treason had begun and ended with delivering the cure. But in what he had seen of the battle, the British dragons had been locked in their same formations, all the same antiquated habits of aerial war. The noise outside the window rose and fell like the sea. Somewhere nearby, glass was breaking. A woman shrieked. The glow increased. He lay down and tried to sleep a little. His rest was broken by ragged eruptions of noise, already falling back into the general din by the time he jarred awake, panting and sore from fragmentary images of the burning ship, which in his dreams became black and glossy beneath the flames, scales curling and crisping at the edges. He rose once. There was a small dirty pitcher of water to which he was not yet thirsty enough to resort for drinking, and he splashed his face a little with a cupped handful. His fingers came away, streaked black with soot and grime. He lay down again. There was more screaming outside, and a stronger smell of smoke. It did not grow light so much as less dark. There was a thick, sooty pall over the city, and his throat ached sharply. No one came with food. There was not a word from his guards. Lawrence paced his cell, four long strides across, three lengthwise from the bed, but he used smaller steps and made it seven. Restless. His arms clasped behind his back, feeling as though they were weighted down with round shot, dragging. He had rowed for 5 hours without a pause. That, at least, had been something to do, something besides this useless fretting away to no purpose. The city burned, and all he could do here was burn with it, or moulder to be taken a prisoner by the French, with Napoleon's army scarcely 10 miles distant. And even if he died, Temeraire might never know, might keep himself a prisoner long after any cause had gone, and stay to be taken by the French. Lawrence could not trust Napoleon for Temeraire's safety, not while Yen was his ally. Her voice and the self-interest which would see him master of the only celestial outside China's borders would be louder in Napoleon's ear than any prompting of generosity.